Welcome to Wonk with Mike. I'm your host, Mike Moffitt, monetary policy dove and Phillips curve skeptic. I recently sat down with Luke Kawa, Bloomberg reporter and Bank of Canada watcher, to talk monetary policy and how Canadians should interpret statements by Bank of Canada Governor Stephen Pelosi. The 2020 Network is presented by Interac. Interac connects everyone to the limitless possibilities of digital payments. Whether you are sending, receiving, or requesting money, using Interac Debit to pay by card, phone, or smartwatch, or looking for a business payment solution, they provide fast, convenient, and secure access to your own money. So before I get into the more wonkish questions, which I will, can you explain to our listeners what the target for the overnight rate is, you know, what the Bank of Canada does, and why should Canadians care about it?
So right now, the recent move in July was a 25 basis point hike that brings the overnight rate up to 150. And why you should care? Well, if you're a variable rate mortgage, you'll notice that the banks immediately changed their prime lending rate after this decision. A number of them, you'll notice they don't tend to do it as quickly when rates are cut. But why you should care is that it'll affect everything from the borrowing you're paying on your mortgage to the value of the Canadian dollar. And the thinking here is in that setting monetary policy and having these effects on exchange rates, on interest rates, and on asset prices transmit through the economy over a period of time. That's going to, at the margin, influence business decisions, whether to expand capacity in Canada, whether, you know, an appreciation of the loonie would make it more attractive to go elsewhere, whether higher interest rates put off borrowing by households or maybe have them, you know, purchase a smaller home, hold off purchasing a car, go with a used car for a while. So it's all about influencing activity. And if monetary policy does it right, you almost won't know sometimes that you've been nudged in a certain way because of what's happened, you know, 12 to 24 months ago.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the frustrating things about monetary policy is when it works, it almost seems like it's doing nothing. You know, I'm reminded back of the old sort of Y2K bug where afterwards people said, oh, well, that was so overblown. And it wasn't really overblown. Is it that we did a pretty good job of fixing it? So, you know, so what is the sort of monetary stance now of the Bank of Canada? Like, what are they trying to do in 2018?
Right now, I think a good change that kind of happened yesterday and has been in the process of happening, the bank is trying to normalize policy, and they use the word normal for a reason. Governor Pelosi has spoken about this idea that, you know, the economy is at full capacity, so in other words, the output gap is at zero, and that means essentially we've grown as much as we can without generating an acceleration in inflation. The bank's number one job is to target inflation. So he's been saying, you know, everything about the economy looks kind of normal except for interest rates. And he's drawn like a number of different lines in terms of where an appropriate level of interest rates might be. One thing he's used to say, well, you know, policy is stimulative right now. And one way we know that is because real policy rates, so that 1.5 adjusted for inflation, which headline inflation is running at 2.2, and the core measures are averaging 1.9 right now. So it's in negative territory on a real basis. I happen to think zero is just a number. I don't know why we're drawing the line at zero as a stimulative threshold or not. But that would be the first threshold that they would look to cross before starting to worry about whether they're really hurting the economy. And then they think the neutral rate, so the rate at which their policy is neither restraining nor stimulating economic activity in the absence of material headwinds or tailwinds to the economy, they think that range is 2.5 to 3.5%, so midpoint around 3. So right now I describe the stance as fairly accommodative, and I think what they're trying to do is get the rate higher as long as things keep going according to plan. And the governor has mentioned on many occasions that their models seem to be working better. And this is a gentleman who returned to the bank in 2013 saying, our models are a better source of questions than answers, like an old sailor at sea using these navigational tools and the stars that didn't really work. Now he's saying, you know, we nailed first quarter growth at 1.3%. We've nailed these interest rate sensitive consumer segments slowing down. We nailed the housing market stabilizing. So he thinks he knows what's going on, and he thinks that kind of gives him room to keep lifting rates.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, Pelosi historically being sort of a trade type guy, and that was always one of the problems the Bank of Canada had, was going back a few years ago that they weren't seeing the uptick in exports, an uptick in manufacturing that they thought going into 11, 12, 13. So when you talk
14, about 15.
14, too. 15, yeah. 14, 15, that's right.
Yeah.
So, you know, is there anything we can attribute, you know, the fact that the model seemed to be working better? Have they been tweaked, or are we just going into a more sort of normal period?
So one thing they did change, and I believe it was, you know, mid 2017, maybe early 2017, they changed the weighting on their export model in terms of what drives Canadian exports, and they shifted it more away from U.S. business investment used to have a very dominant weight. They took that down, upped U.S. government and upped U.S. consumption. And I don't know necessarily if exports are one thing that have necessarily responded very well to their models. For instance, you know, the line in the sand I like to draw is mid 2014. So that's when oil started to tank, Canadian dollar started to tank. The bank was forced unexpectedly into a stimulative stance that probably it was going to go the other direction fairly quickly had oil not tanked. And since then, we have U.S. real imports up about 15% and Canadian real goods exports, including energy, up 4%, not including energy, up 0.3%. So that response in terms of rising U.S. demand and, you know, what we would expect to see in non-commodity exports and non-energy exports has been very lacking. And the governor, I believe, and the bank attributes that to enduring competitiveness challenge and the fact that we've lost so much capacity. Like, Mike, you know, Southwest Ontario, you saw a lot of companies go the way of the woolly mammoth, and that capacity hasn't necessarily been built up. A large part of the bank's story is that right now, business investment and export growth that kind of need to go hand to hand for us to be able to boost exports. Companies that are running with the highest capacity utilization since the first quarter of 2006, they need to boost capacity. That's a huge part of the story right now. And that's kind of hard to do with the NAFTA overhang that we've got.
Yeah, no, it really is. And you know, again, I was one of the people who were more sort of skeptical of the sort of export story going into 13, 14, and 15, because I always saw, you know, there was this thinking that, oh, you know, exports were going to go up as the stronger U.S. economy of the lower dollar thanks to the oil shock. And I was going like, well, who's going to export? Like, Sterling Truck is closed. You know, all of these factories within Southwestern Ontario are closed. So, you know, it was always hard for me to see that story. So, if it's not being export driven, like is this sort of domestic driven consumption, and where is that coming from? Is it coming from housing starts or other parts of the economy?
Well, I think in the near term, just there's been, you know, some weather related issues. They expect a consumption rebound that's largely just, you know, mirror image of that as purchases pick up. But they do still kind of expect an export boost, and this is where you can get that serial disappointments factor. But on the exchange rate front, you were mentioning, Pelosi gave a great speech that I think, you know, everybody missed. It was to a largely academic community, and it was talking about why we really can't assume and go by that relationship between a currency's move and then exports. And a lot of it has to do with the same reasons why right now we're so worried about NAFTA and we're so worried about auto tariffs. Supply chains have become so globalized and so interwoven. So think about it this way. If a company for producing a final product is going to be Linamar is the example I think the Canadian government likes to use, going back and forth across the border to, you know, add parts at different stages in the process, then what is the real exchange rate effect on that? It's muted. It's muted. So for a given change in the exchange rate, we should expect a smaller effect on net exports relative to the past. So relative to, say, you know, the pre-NAFTA and certainly the pre-China into WTO arrangement. So that's a big thing that's changed, and I think it's ruined an old rule of thumb we used to like. But for now, kind of the bank sees this year as a big investment year, and then next year then being a fairly decent export year, but consumption still kind of carrying the day, and that's a story of labor markets tight, wages going up, still have some immigration. It's almost like a body in motion tends to stay in motion is how I think of their consumption story right now. It doesn't seem to be, they don't seem to feel the need to justify it too much.
So, first of all, you have one of the most informative Twitter accounts out there. So I'm just going to advocate that everyone give Luke a follow. So for the next few minutes, I'm going to read out a few of your tweets sort of one at a time as a starting point for a conversation and get you to expand on them. So I'm going to go back to this idea that you've mentioned the term normalization a couple times. You tweeted that yesterday reminded me of something Chris Reagan once told me. All central bankers would like to get back to a time when monetary policy was normal, and monetary policy is normal when it's boring. So can you expand on that? Like what makes it boring? How is it different, in normal times versus monetary policy in a crisis?
I think Kevin Carmichael's at the Financial Post has kind of written recently on this, on just the cult of central banking and why we care about it a lot more. And a big reason is that, you know, Mark Carney, as such, got thrust into rock star status because in a lot of cases, well, in Europe mainly, governments were unwilling or unable to fully step in and help save the day in the wake of the financial crisis. And central banks did a lot of heavy lifting and did things people never heard of before and people thought could never be done. Like in the case of negative interest rates, people thought, you know, well, we'll just, people will leave banks to avoid getting hit by the charge, and then, you know, the transmission mechanism will completely break down and will descend into chaos. So the fact that the experimentation of central banks was so great in the post immediate aftermath of the crisis kind of, you know, it thrust them more into the public consciousness a lot more. And since there's been a certain asymmetry for a certain amount of time, because rates across the developed world have still remained kind of close to zero, and there's worries about what will happen as we attempt to move away from Wonderland, so to speak. So for me, what normal is and why it's boring is when we're able to say, okay, we're not worried about downside risks as much because we're so far removed from the crisis, because inflation is finally picking up in a lot of places after being very, very slow and moribund for 5 years, for a long, long time. So the fact that economies are starting to look more like they did before the crisis, but at a slower rate of growth because we have an aging population, and, you know, that both directly weighs on how fast you can grow because it's the slower growth of labor input, and as well aging populations tend to have demand for fairly non-productive segments of the labor market, nursing care and, you know, that kind of public assistance in the healthcare space is not generally considered higher productivity. So it hurts your potential growth in two ways. But besides that, things look normal, and being able to respond to the divine coincidence in central banking, this idea that, you know, we have a trade-off between unemployment and inflation, that Phillips curve relationship, and that things are going right when we think unemployment is low and the lowest it can be, and inflation is stable at 2%, that describes now more or less Canada and the US. So it's normal and boring when central bankers are withdrawing accommodation and lifting rates in response to an environment like that.
I'd like to push on the sort of the Phillips curve piece a little bit. So we had Justin Wolfers on the podcast about a month ago, and we talked about the fact that, you know, in the past we had this concept of the natural rate of unemployment, and, you know, we always thought about it depending on the country and the context of being sort of 5 to 6%, and Now we're seeing in places like the United States, unemployment go under 4%, and still we're not seeing these inflationary pressures. So, how do we sort of navigate that, that sort of trade-off, even in a normal time, when it looks like some of the metrics or sort of rules of thumb that we've used might not be as applicable?
We should start by throwing Nehru out. We should. You can toss it. You can bin it. I think I don't know how practical it is for monetary policy. And if there is a trade off between the rate of price increases for the economy and the very pernicious destructive effects of people who would like work being out of work for a long period of time and the health and the social effects that has, I know which one I would rather place more emphasis on. I personally would prefer a model that paid more emphasis on real variables than nominal ones, which of course is anathema to classic thinking about central banking. But that's a problem. And in the US, we're having the most recent month of payrolls data for both Canada and the US. But in the US specifically, we saw a big jump in labor force participation. And there's this metric called the available pool of labor. So that's the total unemployed plus those not in the labor force, but say they would want a job. Think about this. We're so far into the US expansion. We think we're running through Slack. No, that available pool of labor had its second biggest jump of the U.S. expansion upwards this late in the cycle. That should tell you ex ante, we have no clue how to identify labor slack. And if we really care about a society as getting as many people to work as possible to ameliorate the destructive effects that has both on political stability and a person's personal health and welfare, then I would think concepts like Nehru are very destructive to that and undermine that whether you think about it or not.
So I think you and Justin Wolfers, I think, are in violent agreement with that, though Andrew Coyne, probably, if he's listening to this, is probably hearing, probably shaking his head at that sort of nominal versus real, but we'll leave that one for a while. So, we've got these indicators that we've used in the past. They might not be, that helpful, and we're still trying to sort of figure out how fast rates can go up, what the new normal is on these things. So I want to read another one of your tweets and have you walk us through it. And you said, listen to what Pelosi, this is on statements made by the Bank of Canada. And your tweet is, listen to what Pelosi says that's new. When he repeats chatter about the existing risk they've been talking about before, that's not dovish. So could you expand on that and talk about how we should be analyzing the statements coming from the Bank of Canada?
So I think the governor's done ever since the last year's September hike, they've done kind of yeoman's work on trying to explain to people how and what they think about things. So that means essentially any time you hear him talk, he will, and this goes for Senior Deputy Governor Carolyn Wilkins as well, they will try to give a full assessment of the risks. It's their risk management approach. They give you the whole shebang, and then, you're left to figure out, well, where do they fall in this balance of risk? So every time they are going to mention, as long as this NAFTA overhang persists, they are going to mention that this is a downside risk. They are going to mention that it could get worse. They are going to say they are aware of this and are, modeling out scenarios that they won't discuss publicly because it's too soon and things haven't been implemented yet besides steel and aluminum tariffs. But they're going to talk about it and they have to talk about it because it shows you they don't have their heads in the sand. They know what's going on. When they bring up things that are new, and in the June 27th speech, I think this is referring to, Pelosi essentially said, and this is something as a Bank of Canada watcher that jumped out at me, he said, financial markets, when they interpreted our May statement, we think they got it right. And then I look at, what happened in the market the day of the May statement? The Bank of Canada removed a reference to being cautious in how it would normalize rates. And the odds of an interest rate hike went from something like 55 to 75 in a day. So, if the markets got it right that day in marking up the probability by that much, I can turn off my brain a little and say, he's telling me something very simple. I should not try to overthink this. I should just strip that out and run with it. And I think ultimately that's, markets were fairly volatile that day, but I think once the dust settled, that's when things started to move up in the direction that kind of got everyone on board, both on Wall Street, on Bay Street, and the market, in terms of knowing that the July hike was coming.
Yeah, I don't know what more he could have done to telegraph that, other than, you know, put out a memo saying we're going to raise rates. So you mentioned some of this uncertainty around tariffs and other sort of economic factors. So, let's talk a little bit about this risk management approach. So it's going back a while ago, but you once tweeted, "What I'd like to see from the Bank of Canada today, how their rhetoric on trade at all comports with a risk management approach, especially Trump starting to follow through on stuff." So could you expand on that? Like, how should the Bank of Canada respond to what I guess we could call known unknowns of, well, you know, we know that they're at least thinking about doing something on tariffs, but we don't know when and what that looks like. So, you know, how should the Bank of Canada sort of preemptively respond to known unknowns using a risk management approach?
Well, in the most basic answer, I think would be that it would suggest more caution in raising rates. However, I think the way they've gone about it is saying because these things haven't happened, we can't assume they are going to happen, and we have to proceed, you know, according to the data. And it's, you know, it's a very faithful approach to, you know, a great moderation type central banker wanting to keep inflation expectations stable. And, you know, the Bank of Canada only has one mandate, so, and on that front, it makes sense. But the way I kind of have been thinking about it is, you know, you have to make a judgment call, and you have to assign, you know, some probability. Try narrow it down, make it a range, give it something. But if your decision tree splinters as, you know, auto tariffs are a 15% chance of happening, oh, how does that change what we might do for rates now? Because we know that effect filters out throughout the economy for the next, you know, 12 to 24 months before it's fully felt. And for me, it would just generally augur for more caution in what you're doing as long as this overhang persists. However, I think Carolyn Wilkins, especially yesterday, did a great job in explaining that, you know, they don't think this is necessarily a panacea, even in the event of a, you know, an auto tariff or a dissolution of NAFTA. They see that as more a structural shock, and, you know, monetary policy can't fix everything. And in that situation, they also might start to get worried about, rising prices as supply chains break down and the effect on inflation expectations. So it's possible, I wouldn't think it likely, but it's possible that price effects would dominate over output effects at that point in time. That's something they at least opened up yesterday. But in general, the whole trade issue just argues for a little more caution. I also think rates would be higher right now if not for the NAFTA overhang.
So this touches on another one of your favorite Twitter topics. So back in January, you tweeted, "Data dependence versus outlook dependence. The weighting and handicapping of those is what it's all about next week." So we don't need you to go into particulars about the January decision, which was a rate hike. But could you walk us through that, the difference between a data dependence and an outlook dependence when the Bank of Canada is making these decisions?
The best thing I think I can turn to is 3 years prior to that, is January 2015, right before the Bank of Canada surprised everyone and cut rates in response to the oil shock. At that time, core inflation measures were north of 2%. We had just come off a growth that was, you know, clearly above trend growth. And if you're just looking at the data, there's no reason to even think about cutting interest rates. But a lot of things color your outlook of how you think the economy will evolve. And in Canada's case, and in particularly Alberta's case, a huge fall in oil prices is going to monumentally shape what you think will happen going forward. And I think the U.S. Fed approaches it from, they kind of more explicitly focus on how financial conditions index. So, you know, the level and the appreciation of the dollar, credit spread. spreads, rising yields, and so on, how that affects their outlook for activity. So whenever a central banker says they're data dependent, I think they're somewhat not telling the full truth, because they will always let their forward outlook and their assessment determine what they're going to do today, because they have to, because of that long and variable lag of monetary policy and the fact that it's just not going to have the effect right now, but over a long time.
Well, and that leads to my final question, because you've mentioned the Fed. So my final question for you is, you know, what do you see as being the major differences between how the Bank of Canada operates, signals their attention, and other major central banks around the world? Is there anything particularly special about the Bank of Canada?
I think, and this is what they do here is not necessarily a positive for me as a journalist, but I think it might well be a positive for them in terms of having their message understood by the markets, and especially over the past 9 months. The Federal Reserve is talking all the time. They're on TV, they're writing op-eds, they're doing interviews. There's so much out there. Monetary policy is very heavily personalized, to the point where, like, you know, they have that dot plot showing, you know, everyone's assessment of how they think rates will unfold or should unfold given the realization of their economic outlook over the next 2 or 3 years in the long run. You can pretty much label nearly everyone on that spectrum because of how often they talk and tell you everything that's on their mind. That causes the opportunity for market confusion and market volatility, I would think. A big difference about how the Bank of Canada operates is that really you will only get what I would consider new information from either Governor Poulos or Senior Deputy Governor Wilkins about how the bank's thinking has changed. The bank speaks with one voice. They don't publish minutes, which I don't like. It doesn't give you a sense of the range of debate that is happening at the meeting, and I'm sure there's some good constructive debate. And they also don't vote, so you don't know if there's anyone dissenting from the decision and really vehemently disagreed. So because of the uniformity of the Bank of Canada, it's easier as a watcher to kind of get a grip of when things are changing and why. It might be a little less clear with the Fed, but, you know, of course, if they're talking less, we can't write about them as much, and we don't have, you know, as much drama, as it were.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming to Ottawa. We look forward to seeing you in October with the next release of the monetary policy reports. That may be the next big thing that you get to talk about, since these guys are talking so rarely. So thank you, Luke, for coming to the Canada 2020 studio.
Oh, pleasure to be here. Thanks, Mike.
That was my chat with Luke Kawa. If you liked this episode, make sure to rate and review us on iTunes, and subscribe if you haven't already. It would really help us out. Now, here are the 5 things I learned today. Number 1, Bank of Canada models seem to be working better. This may be due to changes they made in their export model to better reflect the realities of Canada-US trade. Number 2, we should expect a smaller export response to exchange rate movements than in the past, since inter-firm supply chains are so interwoven between Canada and the US, which reduces the exposure that manufacturers have to currency fluctuations. Number 3, the available pool of US labor just had its second biggest jump in our current economic cycle, despite the thinking that the US is already near full employment. Number 4, the difference between data dependence and outlook dependence in setting monetary policy. And number 5, the Bank of Canada speaks far less than the Federal Reserve and speaks in one voice. This makes their message clearer, but also gives reporters less to write about. That was Wonk with Mike on the Canada 2020 Podcast Network. I'm Mike Moffitt. My producer was Sarah Turnbull.
Hey there.
And this podcast was brought to you by Interact.
What did you buy on Interact today, Mike?
Well, Sarah, I bought a trampoline. How about you?
I bought some gum.